This is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, and we're joined today by Father Brendan Purcell, adjunct professor in the School of Philosophy at Notre Dame University, Sydney. Welcome, Father Purcell.
Thanks very much, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Now, we're here to talk about a book that's just been published in 2012 by New City Press called From Big Bang to Big Mystery, Human Origins in the Light of Creation and Evolution. Now, this sounds like a fairly big topic. Maybe you can just introduce it to our listeners.
Well, maybe the best way to start with the Big Bang. The Big Bang is something that we know about through astronomy. In fact, scientists used to think the world had a beginning at about 1930. And so, but it was a question that they came up from that was what started it? And they weren't able to answer it. So in a certain sense, it's kind of like a scientific question that can't be answered by science. So I figured, well, maybe human beings are something like that. We can answer an awful lot of things about us. We know where we come from. We're part of a long, long evolutionary sequence, if you like. And yet what makes us specifically human, we can't adequately answer it, if you like, by all the sciences that we know. So I think human beings are a big mystery. Something like the Big Bang is, but maybe bigger than that.
I was reading one description of your books saying that it was trying to seek out what the Big Bang was of human consciousness. So that's a big question.
Well, there's an American guy, Richard Klein, he's a book, which that's the subtitle of, The Big Bang of Human Consciousness. And I was really surprised when I really got into this. There was no one in Ireland working on it when I got into it, as far as I could see. In fact, very few philosophers are bothered with it. So I went to the University of Chicago and I loads of books there. And so one of the things that I noticed, I thought I'd kind of have, because I come from a philosophical background, which is from Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, all the kind of stuff that you, the usual hardware that Christians have, I figured I'd have a fight on my hands because most of the people in these areas are what they'd call Darwinian materialists. And then I discovered they're writing books like The Human Revolution, that's a two-volume series of essays, The Creative Explosion, and this book by Richard Klein, The Big Bang of Human Consciousness. They were on my side, as if I can speak of having a side. In other words, they were themselves, because they're such honest scientists, the data was getting them to say there's something really huge about humans. That there's a guy called Ian Tattersall, just he's emeritus prof in the Natural Science Museum in New York, but he's, you know, keeps writing about this, and his point is, look, we're continuous, and yet he said there's something totally unprecedented about the emergence of the human. So they themselves, without any philosophical hardware, have got to this point that there's something very mysterious about human beings.
Now, you start the book off by asking, is there a barcode for humanity? What do you mean by that question?
Well, I mean, we all remember President Bush couldn't handle a barcode. Who's the senior guy? Couldn't handle a barcode. I'm sorry, this just comes up. But in other words, it's a standard way of seeing what things what are. And so the point I was making was that, as far as I can work out, I'm following a particular philosopher, Eric Voegelin, and then a bunch more, it seems that only three major traditions clearly worked out what a human being is. Now, I've studied insofar as you can without knowing all these languages, say the Chinese, the classic Chinese experience, Indian stuff. I've even checked out Zoroastrian stuff. None of them really clarify. They break with the myth, the mythic notion that we're part of a big story where, you know, the gods are involved and we're involved and we're all. No one starts out what a human being is. You have to wait until you get it in Greek philosophy from around 500 BC. You get it in the Jewish experience a lot earlier, around 1300, at least very clearly there in Genesis, Exodus, and so on and so forth, where the human being is seen as, Pope Benedict speaks of a relational anthropology. It's a very accurate way of handling the notion of the human having a personal relationship with the divine. And you get it, obviously, in the New Testament. So they're the three. And really there isn't any. So my point is, if we want to use, this is the thing about the books that you mentioned earlier, Tim. They all have words like the human story, the origin of humanity. They, you know, they use the word, but they don't really seem to use human in a very technical sense. So human for them is something that's walking on 2 feet, that generally started maybe 3 million years ago, that really doesn't do activity much different from a highly developed, highly educated chimpanzee. And they're all calling that human, right up to Neanderthal, who are always called as human. Now, there's a reason for that. It's complicated, but it's, I think it's watering down the word human, because if I can quote my favourite, he's an American writer, Walker Percy, and he makes this point. He's a genius on language because he's written about language technically and so on. He's a novelist as well, as you know. But he makes the point that there's more in common between the kind of rings around the planet Saturn and an orangutan than there is between a human and an orangutan. And the reason being is that language and self-consciousness is such a divider, in the sense of obviously we've got the same, I've mentioned, was chatting about it. I've got pretty well the same body build as an orangutan. My arms aren't long enough. I haven't enough fur around. But effectively, I could pass as one of them if you liked. But yet the differences, so we're very, very close to them in terms of physical build. And we're even closer to the humans, the hominids, the beings very like us up to before the humans came up, very close to them. And yet this difference of self-consciousness and language for him is the one that he knows. And so I think that is a really big issue that comes out.
Right. I mean, this approach is very different from one that you would encounter, as you suggest, in the culture today, where it's mostly a purely scientific approach to, mm-hmm, to looking at human development. So you're arguing for that it needs to be broader than that, just looking at
an
that
awful
way.
Lot broader. I mean, I would nearly say, in a certain sense, that the scientific approach, if it's left on its own, now, there are loads of scientists who are quite open. I said the people in the area themselves are open. Like I mentioned, Ian Tattersall, Paul Mellors, there's a whole bunch of them, Stephen Mithen, and so on, Chris Stringer. They're like the guys I can pull out of my hat. They're the top guys writing about it. All of them have no problem. They actually, in the end, say we're the same as animals. These guys, the same people, but the way they write about the human with such awe and such, you know, that we're so different, it seems to imply to me these are scientists who are open to the data. Whatever they finally say, I'm not too bothered about. So I think the point is it's not as bad as it might look, but there are obviously certain types of people in the world of science that, as it were, want to make us all the same as animals and so on. And strangely, it's a bit like what happened before the big three breakthroughs I spoke about, philosophy, Old and New Testament, insights into the human, a complete break with the myth, if you like. They're more like the myth. They're looking at human beings from outside. Like we're like kind of moving, we're building pyramids, whatever we're doing. But there's not really much reflection on what makes a human being human in terms of inwardness. And so that particular breakthrough you get in those three traditions, and then obviously it's been developed enough in our own time, that's missing from at least a certain approach of science to humans. So, and what do they end up with then? You end up with a denial of all the things that make human beings human. You're told, oh, they're just, they use a word epiphenomena, which means external expressions. These are just, you know, external, but they're not really what we are. The reality is, you know the famous book, The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. So basically, we are packages for genes to survive. Now, he's watered it down and, you know, changed around, but basically that's his view, that we are simply the external excrescences of biological forces. We're not really persons. That's the big problem.
Yeah, you mentioned Richard Dawkins. For people like him, Darwin is kind of the person that they look to. I mean, he is a huge influence. You write in a chapter that Darwin, and which you kind of call Darwin and the evolution of evolution, you said he got some things right and some things wrong. Maybe you can go through that.
Okay. Well, I think the things he got right, for starters, the guy was a genius. So what he does is he gets all living things together. And like the mark of a great scientist or anyone is to connect a whole lot of things that nobody has quite brought together that well before. There were other theories of evolution and so on, but his one was the one that made it. And in many ways, it seems to me, with all sorts of qualifications, is working along fine. In other words, an insight into how everything else is connected. It's very interesting. The last paragraph, more or less, of his big book, The Origin of Species, he speaks about how God breathed all this into all his creatures. It's quite interesting. It's in the second to the sixth edition of his book. So it wasn't in the first edition. So in other words, even Darwin, he's a guy that could never make up his mind. He partly believes, he partly doesn't believe, probably more than partly is not knowing. You know what I mean? But what he got wrong, I think partly because he began was what we would call a kind of fundamentalist. When he was studying, he kind of believed that the Bible, say the book of Genesis, had to be literally understood. Then he travels around the world on the Beagle, ends up in Australia, places all over the place, and he sees these layers in which there are different levels in geology, and it doesn't make sense to say that everything happened just as a literal understanding of Genesis. Now, it's quite interesting that one of the major English intellectuals at the same time, John Henry Newman, now blessed John Henry Newman, had absolutely no problem with the Origin of Species. He said, like, maybe from our viewpoint it looks kind of random how all this, but he says it wasn't random to God. In other words, like, he's got an understanding that God isn't in space and time, and there's absolutely no problem with how the whole world could have developed in the way Darwin did. The problem with Darwin is because he's fighting a certain type of fundamentalist, if you like, who is insisting on a literal reading of Genesis, which, remember, Augustine didn't insist on. The people who wrote Genesis did not think God needed a siesta on a Sunday. You know what I mean? Or a Sabbath. They didn't. And the readers knew that as well. So what they were talking about wasn't God. For example, it's funny, if you look at the details, you get light before sun, moon and stars, as far as I remember in the day. So they knew about that. The point was God created everything, including the sun, moon and stars. I mean, Pope Benedict has a lovely little book called In the Beginning, where he goes through that. In other words, what they're doing is a polemic, if you like, against all the created God, the gods that claimed it. But the big point was the whole of the liturgy, the whole of the world was aimed at a liturgy. The 7 days was the whole of the created world was meant to be, as it were, part of a cosmic liturgy, the language of Teilhard de Chardin much later on. You're getting it in Genesis already. So Darwin, unfortunately, didn't have that flexibility in understanding Genesis. So what he reacts against then is a certain type of mentality that says, you don't need to do science. You just read the Bible and you get it out of Genesis. And so you can well imagine, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for the Richard Dawkins of this world, even though they sometimes, I feel, the thing they have slightly what a friend of mine calls designer rage. They kind of get ready, worked up about stuff. They're not necessarily that annoyed, but they nonetheless, they have a point. If I'm told by someone with the word religion on his or her forehead that effectively science is a waste of time because there's a strong anti-intellectualism in that attitude, then you can see the point saying, well, your stuff is a waste of time. And so on. So I think I can understand. So Darwin, to an extent, comes out of that thing, and to an extent, he makes some of his own problems. But he himself didn't. He was very polite, very well educated, and very kind of, you know, best type of English gentleman. So he didn't do that sort of stuff. But certainly some of his modern supporters do. And I don't think it does any credit to biology.
Now, one of your chapters is called "Aren't We 98% Chimpanzee?" I mean, this is sort of a, I guess, conventional wisdom now that, you know, this is, we have evolved from. From the chimpanzees, and that there isn't too much difference there. But you're making the case differently.
I would have no, that, like, even evolution, there's lots of things that we don't understand about it. When I say we, as if I know, but I'm just reading the books about it. But one of the points would be that it's certain that we don't come. They seem to feel what the chimp is one of the three primates. There's like chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and then bonobos that are smarter chimps, a little bit smaller. So they're the four in the primate family, and they're the nearest to us they are. Certainly in terms of genetics, the chimp is even the closest. But then the other group that are mostly gone now, they're all gone, which would be the hominids, will be closer to us again, and so on. So we don't have any living versions, though they're checking out the DNA in them. So there's no doubt about it. There's an enormous amount of come. But I could, there's a book with that name. What's the point about us being 98% chimpanzee by a geneticist called Jonathan Marks over in California? But his point is that, look, 25% of DNA is shared by all living things, as far as I know, even bacteria. So then he makes the point that we have 33% of our DNA is the same as a daffodil's. Does that mean you are 1/3 daffodil? In other words, the point he's making is that your genetic composition isn't really telling you an awful lot. So, for example, you've got things like that are quite different from each other, like hippopotamus and whales, and they've almost identical DNA. So in other words, and you know, they're quite different in appearance and in lifestyle and so on and so forth. There's all sorts of other ones. So the DNA in itself, I've used to say, is, look, it's like when they did the human genome. They didn't find out as much as they hoped from it. Why? Because genetics is at too low a level. It's almost like saying what unites beings is their weight. So just imagine a baby elephant and some human being about the same weight. Getting the same weight doesn't tell you a darn thing about them, other than that they're both animals, they both have four legs if you want, but apart from that, the weight isn't enough, and the genetic thing isn't telling you enough. So it's not helpful. In the sense, what they're really finding now, though, is in the New York Times, just today I was reading it, effectively, like, they're trying to get into these genetic switches. All the so-called junk DNA is far more important, or just as important as the genes that they've been working on for years. So, like, we're only beginning to find out what the stuff means at all, but certainly having almost one last example. There's two orangutans, because I've spoken about them already, and the islands of Sumatra and Borneo. They look physically exactly the same. They have a greater difference in genetic difference between them than we have between any human beings. I'm just trying to say, genetics doesn't tell you enough.
Now, there's one a section of your book where you deal with the seven grace notes in the Sonata for a Good Man. Can you just describe that?
Okay. Well, look, there was a great film called, I can't even remember the name of it just now, but it'll come back to me. A wonderful film that came out a couple of years ago by a German guy, and it's about this Stasi secret police guy, and he's spying on an artistic couple.
Oh, The Lives of Others.
The Lives of Others. Thanks a lot. And so in that, he's converted gradually to becoming a human being by observing them. And at one stage, the guy himself plays music. It doesn't exist. It's in the film Sonata for a Good Man. Now, I have to point out to my readers, which I do, In German, the word Mensch means man and woman. So get off my back. I don't mean just men. So, but I wanted to use the idea of that. And a film review made the point about how some little grace note of kindness can get through to even the most hardened person. And grace note of music is a slight little thing, but I wanted to use it positive in a strong way. So what I do is, because look, an example. In one of the very recent books on anthropology, the guy finishes the book. You see, generally these books are all about the hominid. It's only at the last few pages they deal with us very often. But he just says, the really distinguishing mark of the human is the chin. And in fact, it's true. None of the hominids have chins. In Neanderthals, we've loads of, they don't. And I just think every time I'm shaving, that's my really most human part, this blinking chin I have. So the point is, they generally miss the point. So I figure, why not? I'm sure there's more than seven, but why not just take 7 points that are quite different that we don't find in any of the animals nearest to us. So 3 of them are non-conscious, I call pre-conscious ones. And let's say one is the genetic background. They found that, for example, we come from a single Eve. They call her a mitochondrial Eve. It's a kind of genetic connection in mitochondrial DNA that's handed on only through the females. And they've done a kind of a test of that. And it seems to go back to about 160,000 or thereabouts. And there's two types. There's a slightly earlier, more diverse type because it was around long, maybe had about 50,000 years on its own. Then there's all the rest, and all of us have the same. So they figure had to be a single woman. Now, they don't go into the details of Adam and Eve, it's nothing to do with that, but it's still, they speak of a mitochondrial Eve. Then they speak of the Y chromosome is handed on by men, and so that's similarly a bit of detective work. Again, goes back to Africa, again goes back to maybe around, maybe not quite exactly the same time, it's not a neat fit, but more or less say around 150,000. So what they're saying is the human beings all belong to a single family. There's never a biological reason for racism, for example. The second one then I do is the one about the human brain, the fact that it's got, you know, developments to deal with language and that are quite special to humans. But they're finding more and more stuff about that that I'm not really up on genetically and so on. And then the third one, which I found really interesting, because I knew about the first two in a while, but it was the human development span. That human infants take about 8 years before we can say they're on their own. When I was at school, we used to do a little book called Nedjin in Irish, and it was about a donkey. And like we did it about 5-6 years old. And there was a drawing of a donkey just born. And it always amazed me. The donkey was still able to walk away from its mother. You know what I mean? So even as a kid, you knew that we're very dependent, whereas animals grow up very fast. And they've worked on that. And there's a fine guy called Adolf Portmann, a Swiss guy. And he speaks of the social womb. In other words, all that we learn as humans isn't instinctual. Most of it is non-instinctual, and it takes all those years to pick up not just the language but the folkways of our own people, and we need the nurturing of the parents around us to do that. That's one side of it. So human body plan, it's built into the physics. In other words, Neanderthals grow much earlier. They do enormous work on teeth, and they show how quickly they could grow, and you're getting adult Neanderthals at 4.5 maybe. In other words, they're fully grown. Okay, the other side of life is also interesting, more obvious in women than men, that after women can have children at all, they still live on for maybe at least another 20 years. Why is this? Because in all other animals, after they can no longer reproduce, they hit the road, they're dead, because they've done their work and that's it. Whereas human beings have an inbuilt leaving of women free in order to hand on the traditions of the society with that. So in other words, the human body plan is quite interesting. It's basically human. Then I go on with the other, the more obvious ones at the level of consciousness would be what I use, speak of symbolization, language, understanding and freedom. So I go through those and make the point again that animals don't do this. And the simplest example would be the Neanderthals. They're around for at least 350,000 years. Not once do they leave us a symbol. They make very good tools, better than any of them. I mean, chimpanzees and birds' nests is a tool. In other words, animals are quite capable of making quite sophisticated, you know, instruments in order to survive. But so, and Neanderthals make far better, you know, kind of specially carved stone things and so on and so forth. But there's never any variation. It goes on the same forever, like for 350,000 years. So the point is that they never leave a symbol. So it seems most people work from that. They wouldn't have had language. So that's a special thing. We have symbolization, language, then intelligence and freedom. And the kind of examples I take when I get to them are examples that you can't really find in animals, like lying, systematically living in the lie. In other words, you might sometimes find that animals seem to communicate, and of course they do, but a person who's consciously trying to deceive another person, aware of what they're doing, and I do take examples. And then similarly at the level of freedom, how someone can choose evil. I take famous examples of people like Veligax Speer, who was a Nazi, the third in charge of the kind of Nazi regime and so on and so forth. But then I take examples like Sophie Scholl. She was one of the students that made a protest, a non-violent protest against Hitler in 43 in the University of Munich. She knew what she was doing. Only when the wall fell in East Germany and we got the actual transcript of her trial, of what happened in her interrogation, she comes across like Joan of Arc. No one knew this before. People knew she was a hero, her life had been written, but they didn't have the details. So she's saying to her Nazi guy, her interrogator, who's trying to get her off the hook, the two men are going to die, her brother and another fella, friend of theirs called Crystal Probst, they're going to go. But he wants to save her. So he says, all you've got to say, and he spoke about in his head, he told us later as a golden key, is that you didn't really understand what you were doing. You just went along with it. And this would have saved her life. And she says, but I knew what I was doing. And she knew by saying it that, you know, that she was going to get beheaded as she was just 2 days later when it was all over. And even, like, so what does someone do when they're choosing to lose their life for the sake of, in this case, the value of freedom, the value of Germany? I mean, Germans are so proud to have these people now. There wasn't maybe enough of them. Though I always say, if I was in that situation, if anyone's seen the Pirates of the Caribbean, I'd be Captain Sparrow every time. I don't want to sound as if I'd be the hero. But I'm just trying to say, what do? We look up to people like that. Not all of us are like it.
That's something that distinguishes us from the animals.
From mere survival.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
There's one figure that's important in your book I want you to introduce. People may not be familiar. Is Eddie Hillesum?
Oh, yeah. She's a beautiful example, and she helps me to explain what it is to be a human being. Because if you remember earlier, I spoke of this relational anthropology in the Bible, this notion that, like, we are a you for God. Because, in fact, the way you get it is God, in Exodus, speaks, I am who I am. Let's say. So he identifies himself as an I. But we're addressed. I used to think the Ten Commandments were negative. The really exciting thing is we are addressed in the second person singular as thou. There's no law code from around that time in the ancient Near East that does that. It's always like, if anyone, you know, leaves his bicycle unattended at the pyramids, let's pretend, you know, this will happen to him, whoever does it. You know what I mean? But the notion of thou, so the eye of God addresses each one as a thou. So here's a woman who grew up in Holland, incredibly dysfunctional family, Jewish family, non-practicing. And so, and she's, I think she has had an abortion or something like that. She writes, you know, we know about her through her life and her letters, and was very promiscuous as a student in the university because she was moving from a repressive family home, very joyless, and kind of freedom in Amsterdam, and so on. So let's not pretend that she lived as a saint in any way. She ends up, the war is on, and the Nazis did what they did with Jewish people everywhere in Europe. They appointed special Jews to run things for them. And they figured that they were helping their own people. They were called the Jewish Council. So she was a member of that. So she could go in and out of a concentration camp called Westerbork in North Holland, although I've heard some Jewish person say it was the Hilton of concentration camps. It was like nothing like what you got in the East. Yep. Much better run. Okay, she was helping out there. She even saw Edith Stein going through with her sister one time. And so, but nonetheless, a friend of mine, a guy that wrote a book about her, met one of her friends, and they realized, non-Jewish friends, that they were going to stop and keep all the Jews in there, including the Jewish Council, and they got a taxi to take her away. And Eddie said, you don't understand what you're doing. Like, I've made a choice to stay with my people here. And, like, even though she knew what was going to happen, she stays on. But then she wrote these letters. We have the letters, 600 or 700 pages of letters and diaries. Beautiful stuff. But in them, she's recovering her humanity deeper than she ever had it. And she's reading people like St. Paul, St. Augustine, but she's Jewish through and through. But she has this notion of, she says, my life is a continuous dialogue with you. Her word for God is you with a capital Y. And she kind of gets onto that, and the joy that she has even in the camp of working in his word and then finding him. She speaks of, I'm finding you in everybody, including even in the Gestapo, in the SS guards. So she had this, and she says, we have to reach out to the quad. She says, the Jew Paul, that's her way of speaking of St. Paul, to reach out to love of absolutely everyone. So she's actually drawing on the New Testament to express what she's going through. So there's a huge spiritual recovery over two years basically in this woman. But to my mind, it's like she's my best example of what a human being is in that sense. And in fact, I have three women in the last chapter, and I by accident it turned out one is Catholic, that's Edith Stein, Jewish, who'd be converted because she's a lovely reflection on what it is to be a person. You know, again, she died in Auschwitz, as did Eddie, but like working on the fact, I exist as a person. I can't come from simply my parents. So I had to have, there had to be a personal you. So she's doing this in her own way as a philosopher. And the other woman then was Sophie Scholl, who's a Lutheran. So these women, to my mind, in a way, all of them under the pressure of a threat to their physical existence. And all of them, I think, Sophie was executed in Munich, but the other two died in Auschwitz. But effectively, all of them almost underline the depth of what it is to be human by their courage.
Now, this work is, as indicated by our conversation, you cover anthropology, philosophy, science, genetics. Who do you think this? Who's the audience for this book?
Well, first of all, every Monday morning I had this terrifying experience of 500 students at 10 o'clock. And so it was written very much for them, start off. In other words, they were asking not the same questions as students. When I was working on a book on Hitler in Germany or translating it with some other guy, I could notice in the town I was working, doing the work in Nuremberg, he was working in the university there, like you'd have books by people like Heidegger in the train, in the bookshop, in the train station. Like Europeans read philosophy books. English language students, I doubt if Irish, English, American, Australian are different. They come across questions of the human through medical ethics questions, through human origins questions. And I figured, well, why not deal with what it is to be human that way? Rather than, I mean, I did the other stuff. I did Plato. I did all the other kind of stuff that was there as well. But this was another way of doing it. So I really got into it that way. So I would say first and foremost, it was written for any inquiring young person that would like to have a handle on what it is to be human. And maybe to deal with those questions that come up today about human origins. And remember Aristotle. He spent an awful lot of his middle years doing biology, and as far as he knew it. And he makes this point, and he's got a book on generation, how animals generate. And he says, you know, how does this being that, you know, I know is generated the way and many animals are, but this being that has reason, how does it come into existence? He says, I don't know, I must come back to this question. And that remains, as it were, that's a question for anyone who's interested in human origins in that direction, say the moral or ethical side. Where do human beings come from? What's going on in a being that is both spiritual and physical at the same time? What are the parents doing? What were they doing? So one of the ways I kind of reflect on that is there's an American English poet T.S. Eliot, and he's got a famous line, the intersection of the timeless with time. So it strikes me, what happened when I was conceived? So my mother and father came together. But remember, God doesn't do a whole series of acts. It's sometimes presented as the fact that God infuses a soul into a body. But I think that language sounds too separate. It sounds as if there's a human body provided by the parents and then God blows a soul in there. And there are pictures, I've seen medieval pictures of that. It seems to me that's not near what's happening. There's only one act of creation for everything. It takes 13.7 billion years, if you like, to unfold, but it's only one act of divine love, if you like, behind it. So it seems to me the way of understanding when a couple come together to give a possibility of life to a child, they enter into that one act of love of God. So the intersection of in time with the timeless is how there's one act in which, and the word we use, procreate, and sometimes I prefer the word co-create. So the parents co-create with God one human being. Both, all three are involved, if you like. And so that's an attempt to handle. So people interested in that side of it, I'd say, might like to look at the last chapter. And then anyone interested in those general issues of how do you reconcile, if you like, scripture stuff with science. I discuss that stuff through the book here, there and everywhere. But it's really written in terms of for philosophers, in the sense of not people professional, but at the level of reason. So I'm really, although I will mention the Bible, because I said, okay, I have a section on St. John, the book of Job, just take a little bit out of the old, this is what we mean by human. If you mean by human less than John and Job, if you mean by human less than Plato and Aristotle, I'm sorry, but that's not what a human being is, because they're the ones who define what human being is in our culture and so on. So to say that the chin is our most important thing is really not up to the mark, you know.
Well, you mentioned Richard Dawkins. There's obviously, he's been popular in this country, but also Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett, mm-hmm. other of these new atheists. So it seems to me those books, which have been so popular, this could be kind of an alternative.
Absolutely. And I actually wrote the book partly in mind of Richard Dawkins, because I've had two great sessions with him. And I must say, although he was attacking other people as liars and idiots, he was very nice to me. And I think he's a human being like everyone else. I wasn't attacking him. I admire his work. So I said that to him. And I remember on one program I had where I was chatting about it, and it was a discussion of a book called A Devil's Chaplain. It's a phrase from Darwin. And his essays in that. And one of the essays is a letter to my daughter. Now, he's been married a few times, and the only child he's had is in his second marriage, and that second wife has died since. And obviously, she was taking the daughter to Sunday school, something like that. And he's written the letter when she was 12, saying, don't go. because there's no evidence for this. There's no evidence. And so, now he didn't send it to her, which is fair enough, you know, but it's printed in the book. So I said, well, look, when I read that book and that essay, the thing that came across to me, it wasn't that I agreed with what he was saying, was the love of a father for his daughter. I think you really beloved your daughter and you wanted to keep her from stuff that you felt was false. And he said, yeah. He agreed with that and said, well, look, would you accept that you couldn't prove that really important thing in your life, the love, your love for your daughter, in any laboratory? And he accepted that. And like I would add on, I'm not saying, I mean, the point I would make is then, would you at least accept that maybe an experience of God would be more like your love of your daughter that might need a different way? Aristotle makes the point already. He says, the mark of an educated person not to look for more proof than the subject matter allows. So in other words, Aristotle knows about the difference between different kinds of proofs, like in ethics or logic. And I felt like that was a kind of, and so right through the book, I'm kind of aware I have to write in a way that someone like him, he will disagree with it. But at least it's not an attack on Dawkins. It's an attempt to discuss with those gents as aware, look, this is how someone else looks at it. And I think we could, you know, and I've had experience with Daniel Dennett as well, who's another famous atheist. He came to our university and getting a good chat with him. And so you can talk to these people. The biggest thing that strikes me is their concern for the truth. I'm not really worrying about their motivation. They might have all sorts of, maybe I have lousy motivations, you know. Maybe I'm worse than Captain Sparrow.
Well, on that note, a very rich book, From Big Bang to Big Mystery, Human Origins in the Light of Creation and Evolution. It sounds like people could dip into this at any point.
Well, what I've said to anyone reading it, look, read the introduction, if you haven't a philosophical, and go to the last chapter. And that's about the person as such. And then move slowly back from that and pick out the bits you find interesting. There's some stuff about science and evolution that people who are interested in science will plough through. You mightn't be interested in that. So, and there's loads of subheadings. So pick, you don't have to read it. I read books mostly from the end, except mystery stories. But normally I start at the back.
Well, thank you for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thanks very much, Tim. Thanks for the interview. Thank you.